BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, Anne Scott James, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a curtail step?
Well, it's something which stops one stepping.
Yes, it does, in a way. Yes.
Stops one stepping on a dog.
Yes, in a sense, that's right. You can't step down any further once you've got
You can't?
There.
Well, it's the bottom step, then.
Why?
Because you can't go any further.
Can't go any further. That's all there is.
Yes, I think you creep home. But I wanted something a bit more. The lowest step of a stair with the outer end carried out around the banister. If you remember, the rest of them are sort of confined in a channel, and this step projects out into the hall, or wherever it may happen to be. Now, Dennis Norden. Dennis, what is a grey whacker? Or if you don't like it that way, you can call it a grey wake. But grey whacker is more usual.
It suits my particular purpose a bit better. If it were grey whacker, because then I could offer the suggestion that it's an elderly Liverpudlian. Actually, a grey whacker could be one of those ladies who have this yearning to be primitive, which I'm assured by various lady journalists that this is what housewives have today. They want, surrounded by sophistication, they yearn to be primitive. And they're people who don't believe in detergents, so they still do their laundry by hitting it with a rock. I think such a lady could be a grey whacker.
One bit that was right, Dennis, on there, was it? The bit about the rock.
Was it? See? That's free associating. It's much better than actually knowing. Well, it's some kind of rock, Jack, which has the name Grey Whacker printed right the way through.
I was going to give you half a mark, but you got so well on the way to the complete answer, I'm going to give you one. It's a conglomerate rock, which consists of rounded pebbles and sand, all cemented together in the course of geological time. And it's a German word meaning grey clay. Now, Anne Scott James, what's the meaning of cabrio?
Bad legs for miniskirts.
Yes, very.
Sort of bow-legged, but yeah. It's applied to furniture.
And
it's the type of a leg, furniture leg, which has a curve and then a little sort of bobble on the end of it.
Perfectly good. About what century?
Oh, 18th century.
Yes, fair enough. That's all right. Cabriole is a kind of curved leg. It's characteristic both of Chippendale and a bit earlier, Queen Anne furniture. And it's called that because it was supposed to look like a goat's foreleg. It ought to be capriole from the Latin word for goat. Frank Muir, what is a Menshevik?
It's a Russian gentleman.
Yes.
Memory serves me right. Originally, there were two sort of major sects of the left persuasion.
Yeah.
Bolsheviks and Mensheviks.
Yeah.
And Bolsheviks are the ones that won.
That's absolutely right.
And Mensheviks are the ones that didn't.
I think that's quite good enough. Well done, Frank. He was a Menshevik, was a Russian socialist of what was supposed to be the more moderate party, and perhaps because of that they lost. It means a minority within the party, whereas Bolsheviki means, or is supposed to mean, the majority party. Before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I hope that the two women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations, because at the end I shall ask where the quotations come from. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, here's your quotation. Have gun, will travel. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, yours is, many hands make light work. And at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. And then round two. Over the years, we've got used, I suppose, to countries being given poetic names from time to time, like the Land of the Rising Sun, which I believe is Japan, or the Dark Continent, which is Africa, and so on. For 2 marks, can you answer the following questions along similar lines? Dennis Powell, what is Albion, and can you suggest why it was so called?
It's England, and perhaps takes in a bit of the general area of Britain.
Yes, but who first thought of that?
The Romans.
That'll do.
The Romans.
Now, why did they call it Albion?
Wait a minute now. Was it white?
Yeah.
It was white.
Was white.
Had white cliffs.
Ah, home and dry. 2 marks. Albion was the name given to Britain by the Romans, I think the Greeks as well, more or less. And the reason is that if they looked at it from France or Gaul or whatever it's called, they could, on a clear day, see the white cliffs of Dover, and they called it Albus, in Latin for white. Dennis Norden, which country is, rather surprisingly, called the Pearl of the Antilles?
Well, it's certainly a surprise to me. If I had the slightest idea where the Antilles are or is, I'd be in better shape.
I don't know whether the chap was called K or Che, but he's very well known.
What?
Guevara?
Not Guevara.
Mm.
Yeah?
Well, where did he come from?
Well, now, wait a minute. Well, Cuba is, yes, is the association, but I don't think he actually came from Cuba.
You may well be right, but anyway, that's the association. Yes. Oh. 1 out of 2, because I did help. Curious enough, the Pearl of the Antilles is the large island of Cuba. Anne Scott James, which country was known as Helvetia, and why?
Switzerland?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is a nice point?
Hmm.
Hmm.
J. Caesar.
Well, just about to say, the, obviously a Roman Latin,
yeah,
word.
Where the Helvetii or,
that's
or
right,
something.
Absolutely right. Dead right.
That doesn't explain.
Doesn't explain it. No, I don't think you've given us.
It's called Helvetia
right,
because it was called Helvetia.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, it is Switzerland. No argument about that. In Roman times, it was the land where the Helvetii tribe lived, and if you look at the back of any foreign travelling Swiss car, you can still see it. It's called CH, which is Confederatio Helvetica. Thank you. What country is or was known as the Land of Cakes?
Dundee.
Give it to you if you'll enlarge the area a bit. I mean, Dundee's only one place in it.
Oh, Scotland?
Yes. That's what I wanted.
Bannocks.
Well, yes, that too.
And oat cakes.
Yes, all that.
Oat cakes.
it comes from...
I could have said Eccles, couldn't I?
Forget your 2 marks, and it comes from Robbie Burns himself. He wrote a poem with a rather long title, on the late Captain Grose's peregrinations through Scotland, collecting the antiquities of that kingdom, which begins about the Land of Cakes. Next round is a round of questions about books and their authors and some of the characters in those books, and 2 marks again for correct answers. Tell us, Powell, in what series of books by what author do you find Br'er Fox and Br'er Rabbit?
Uncle Remus.
Yes.
By.
It's difficult, this, isn't it?
By. Somebody called Harris.
Yes, well done.
Oh.
Yes, you're absolutely right. 2 marks. Now, Dennis Norden, Frank Richards created a whole series of schoolboy characters. What were the names of the schools at which Harry Wharton and Tom Merry were educated, if that's the right word? And also, what was Frank Richards's real name?
Harry Wharton was at Greyfriars.
Yes.
Along with Bob Cherry and Harry Ramsett Jansen. Hello, 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 said Bob Cherry. And well, who's
the other school?
The other school was St. Jim's.
Yes, quite right. And the other thing is, Frank Richards wasn't his real name.
No. It was a shame not to remember that, because he only died quite recently,
yes, he did.
I believe, and he was very old, and he was still writing very, yes, prolifically. I can't remember what his name was.
He lived in my hometown, Broadstairs, Kent.
He used to boast of that, yes. Yeah.
I think
I'm sorry, I can't remember his name.
1.5 out of 2. Grey Friars and St. Jim's were the correct answers for the schools. The real name of Frank Richards was Charles Hamilton. And now, Anne Scott James. At the turn of the century and in the first quarter of the 20s, there was a lady called Mary Mackay, and she gained a good deal of fame with her very romantic popular novels. The first of them was A Romance of Two Worlds. What was the pen name by which she became famous, and can you give me one other title of any of her works?
Was it Ouida?
No, you're on the right track, but it's not the right one. Mary...
Turn of the century. Mary, Mary...
I think...
Put it in French.
Marie.
Oh, yes. Marie Corelli.
All right, give me another word.
Yeah, there's one about Satan.
Satan, there is, yes.
Satan, something. There's one called The Mighty Atom.
That's right. Mm. Yes, it'll do.
What was the Satan one?
Sorrows of Satan.
Sorrows of Satan.
Yes, he was a very sad chap. I think one and a half out of two. I did give you a fair amount of help. Marie Corelli... was the name she took, Mary Mackay, and she wrote a whole series of these novels, Barabbas, The Sorrows of Satan, The Mighty Atom, Temporal Power, The Young Diana, Secret Power, and so on. Now, Frank Muir, in which novel by which author would you find the characters Damon Wildeave, Tomsin Yobright, Eustacia Vye, and Diggory Venn?
If the fifth is Big Ears, I'm on your...
Those names again. Hardy?
Sorry?
What?
Hardy, yes.
Hardy?
Yes, you said it right.
I thought it was Thomas Love Peacock. I was Thomas Hardy, the poet of Wessex.
Yes, do you remember which particular book?
I didn't even know it's Thomas Hardy.
It was Thomas Hardy, and it was The Return of the Nation.
Oh.
Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Dillis Power, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Have gun, will travel.
It sounds like somebody in a film.
It's on telly.
On telly.
Telly, yes.
Richard Boone.
It was Richard Boone.
Yes, that's right. American television series, Richard Boone starred. It is itself, I think, a sort of parody of what used to happen in earlier days, pantomime, music hall and whatnot, where people used to advertise such a thing as have skin, will travel. This is the chap who played the cat in pantomime, and have double bass, will travel. That's fairly obvious, too. Now, Anne Scott James, can I have the origin of your quotation? Many hands make light work.
Oh, it's a sort of nanny's proverb, I think.
One out of two, because it
Ben
does...
Ben Johnson.
It does come... No, it does come in a book of proverbs. It comes in Haywood's Proverbs in 1546, and it's later quoted by Samuel Butler and Hudibras in the 18th century. But it's supposed first to have been invented by Erasmus, who wrote it, as he usually did, in Latin.
We didn't have it in Latin. Of course, if you'd given it to me in Latin, I'd have said immediately Erasmus, just like that.
Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how those quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so, back to Frank Muir and his quotation, have gun, will travel.
Well, this story is really a sort of a quest item, because I did a story about my dog a few months ago. And I had a very nice letter from the people who asked me to tell another story, because she was a puppy then, and what she's like now, she's grown a bit. The letter was from the solicitors who are acting on behalf of the Afghan Hound Breeding Association, and apparently their case for slander isn't quite complete, and they were hoping if I did another story about them, they could complete the case, and it would be watertight, and they could bring it to court. So only happy to oblige, Kasanis is now 10 months old, therefore a teenager, and she still looks as though she wears golden pyjamas, which are slipping down, but her paws are now like fur-bearing boxing gloves, each of which are capable of retaining a pint and a half of stinking pond water, which has to be squeezed out. Now, we've got a couple of poodles, and when you're eating, you know, the poodles they're actually big, because they're not sensible enough, and their bottoms aren't big enough to sit up, but they sort of whinny and snuffle and snort and sneeze and make all sorts of noises to attract your attention. But not Kasanis. She just sits aloofly looking away. And if you have something like roast beef, she doesn't even, her nose doesn't even twitch at the smell of it. Just when you reach for the mustard, whoosh, she's got the lot. They are born thieves. They won't beg or even accept anything for you, just pinch the lot. Now, Afghans are big dogs, and rather like brontosauri in government departments. They don't realise how big they are, you know. And also how fast. An Afghan can get up a speed of 30 knots with about 40 feet to run. And she loves doing this behind somebody like Granny. And and over they go, tumble, tumble, and she loves it. And it really is great fun. And she loves really sort of dragging things about on the lawn, you know, tree trunks and shopping bags and Granny. And come on, girls, come on. Let go of Granny's wrist. Good girl, you know. But no, and she, the Afghans also like height. It's this thing of obviously, you used to, the hills of Afghanistan, they like getting up high. There's a pile of builder's sand. She'll sit on it all day, and she likes sitting on the hedge now. And she clambers along the hedge. It's about a five-foot hedge, privet hedge, and she walks along it with that sort of steady, sinking, ponderous gait of a trout fisherman working his way up the test. And the great thing about it is that she not only goes up, but she also goes down. I found this when I came home late one night and came in the back way and stumbled down a shell hole. And I wondered what had happened, and I climbed out of it. It was pitch dark, it was a moonless night, and I fell down another one. And getting to the back door was like crossing the Somme battlefield. I wondered, there must be some explanation that my wife was getting rid of the daisies with gelignite or something. The following morning, we looked up the Care and Maintenance of Afghan Hound booklet, and apparently they also dig. And they dig very powerfully and very rapidly and dig craters, and always around the base of trees. And this, to me, was a great breakthrough. Because if you think, this is really what's made my whole attitude toward Cassonese change, because you can make money out of an Afghan hound. Because they have this instinct for scooping up earth, digging four-foot craters at the foot of trees. And I reasoned why. Truffles. You know, those bits of black rubber you get in French pate. Terribly valuable. Now, obviously, in Afghanistan, they're used to digging this stuff up. In Afghanistan, I mean, the natives, the Afghanistans, probably eat truffles and rancid yak's butter like we eat fish and chips. You know, they're used to finding it. So I thought, if I can really train her to dig for truffles, then I can rent her out. And we've, as the French do, hogs. And we can make a lot of money. So I put a card in the tobacconist window at Virginia Water, and I put on it just simply, and in a way it was rather like the title of a television series, I just wrote simply, Afghan will truffle.
Now, on to Dennis Norden. If you remember, his quotation was, many hands make light work.
I was taking part in one of these Any Questions Brains Trust type programs recently, and somebody got up and asked, do the panel agree that violence in contemporary films has a harmful effect on the community? It was a very good question and original. And the lady member of parliament who was sitting by the water jug, she got very eloquent about it. And she said, yes, there is too much violence in these films, and it is having a bad effect on the community. And why in heaven can't they make films about decent subjects and happy people? And I personally think these filmmakers have a responsibility to the community which they're abrogating. And if I had my way, I would take each one of them and make an example, take them out and horsewhip them and thrash them within an inch of their lives. And then perhaps there'd be a little less violence in this world. Well, I woke up at this because it's relevant. It was relevant to something that I was working on at the time and still am. You see, I also think the market for violence is finished. The pendulum has swung, as the which was the striking phrase that this lady MP used. And I, personally, it suits me because I also am slightly against violence, partly on principle, partly by background, partly because I'm a terrible physical coward, but I disapprove to the extent I can't even eat whipped cream. In fact, I wrote a letter to the Times about it, saying that I think that the way people are depicted in films is wrong, and that people aren't basically violent. They're basically very gentle and considerate, and the average man in the street would not go out of his way to do any violence, and we shouldn't inflict this kind of thing on it. And I think the Times would have printed it, except I got coshed on the way to the letterbox with it. But where all this had the relevance, you see, is that I had started to write a film script which had the idea of trying to exploit this swing away from violence, a non-violent film. And I called it Bonnie and Clyde. No, not that one. This is a remake of that. Yeah. And the story would be about this fellow, Clyde Barrow, who only starts off in the film doing these antisocial things. He does do sort of slightly horrible antisocial things, like going round or telephone boxes and gluing the receivers down, you know, stealing ladies' handbags and licking all their trading stamps. But that's only the beginning, you see. That's only, he's all right later, but at this beginning, he's never done a stroke of work in his life until one day he meets this very sweet girl, Bonnie Parker, who works in a bank as a cleaner, actually. And the bank is owned by her two elderly aunts, who I picture as two absolutely adorable old ladies who go around saying, "Land's sake" and "Heavens to Betsy," you know, and all that terribly lovable American folk stuff. And they take an interest in him. They see that he's not really a bad person, because there are no really bad people. It's society that's made him what it was. And until the age of 16, he never had any opportunities, and nobody even went as far as buying him an orange, you know. So they buy him half a pound of oranges, and they offer him a job in the bank as assistant cleaner, which he takes, and he discovers eventually that stealing thousands and thousands of dollars and going around having a marvellous time with drinks and women, so it isn't anywhere near as nice, really, as working as an assistant cleaner in a bank for $15 a week, particularly when the one you love is cleaning alongside you, you see. So that is what they do, and they end up, the two together, as cleaners in the bank, and they go around to little wayside petrol stations and say, "I am Bonnie Parker and this is Clyde Barrow, we scrub banks." And I really do think that this would be much more true to life than that horrible sordid version we saw originally. And what's more, I think the quotation that Jack gave me to work on will make a rather nice publicity slogan for the film. Bonnie aunts make Clyde work.
By your vote, the contest of the stories is won by Dennis Norden. Nevertheless, the entire contest of my word this evening is won by the other team, Dilys Powell and Frank Muir, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.